So here in Romans, we get this a wonderful summation of what the duty is of the Christian. Remember, Paul has started since chapter 12, verse 1, on this question of how should we live. He's spent the first 11 chapters setting out his understanding of both time and history of humanity and how humans in their rebellion against God have fallen into all sorts of excesses and problems. But then he introduces the work of Jesus into this mix and the work on the cross and God's work to bring us into salvation. And all of this Paul has treated. And then because he knows that such a glorious and It's a truth that exists on the highest plane possible. It exceeds human thought. So when we're up there thinking and listening, any number of things could be our sort of next thought as we come back down to earth. We could say, well, you know, as people did during Paul's day, well, if Jesus has conquered all sin, then sin's not a problem. So if you sin, don't worry about it. And Paul says, no, sorry, we can't make that conclusion. That's not true because we're dead to sin. So he's treated some of these things earlier, but he realizes that there's very practical need to decide how we should live, and in particular, how we should live together in community. And so if it's no longer the law that identifies us, no longer circumcision, no longer connection to the physical descent of Abraham and his people through Isaac, the son of promise, then what? How do we define ourselves? How do we understand? How do we govern ourselves? How then should we live is the question. And so Paul gets back to being, again, potentially very, high level thought, this whole idea that all you need is love, right? And just love God, love your neighbor. It's a wonderful precept. Augustine says, love God and do what you want, or do as you will, do as you purpose and intend. But again, these have the potential to kind of just be anything goes then. Whatever I understand love to be is what I need to do. And so Paul disabuses us of that. He takes that option away from us by saying, why love? Because love fulfills the law. You thought Paul got rid of the law. Paul did not get rid of the law. Paul got rid of what blocked the law of being able to be enacted by us. We were helpless before the law to do the righteous requirements of God. This is Romans 7 again, and getting into Romans 8. And Paul says, so the problem was not with the law. The problem was with our ability to live out according to the requirements of the law. And now that Jesus has come, that obstacle has been taken away, that obstacle being our human nature, unenlightened and unredeemed, sanctified by Jesus. So love is the fulfillment of the law, and if you want to know what it looks like to love your neighbor, well, you could go back to Romans 12 last week, right? All of these things that Paul was talking about, or as he says today, all these commands, murder, adultery, covetousness, lying, all of these things are dealt with if you truly love one another, if you love the other. That fulfills all the law. So now, Paul is understanding himself to say, because what I've told you about what God did in Jesus Christ is true, and because what I've told you about what it means to be baptized into Christ, being baptized into death so that you can be dead to sin, alive to God, just like Jesus was. Because all these things are true, you need to live this way. But Paul also wants to remind us that behind all of that is this great doctrine of the sovereignty of God. And that's, you know, maybe that's a fancy word. You know what sovereigns are? They're coins, but they're also kings or rulers. Queens and kings are sovereigns. And so the sovereignty of God means that he is king and his authority is the ultimate reality in the universe. And so Paul can tell us two things. He can say, Therefore, you need to submit to the government in the place where you live. The government is established by God. Its authority is derived from the authority that God has delegated out of his ultimate authority, and you need to submit, which can be very conservative. That is, because it's establishing and safeguarding the status quo, and that's what conserving means. That's what conservative means, is that you want to preserve what is. So that could be very conservative, but it's also very radical in a day in which we all believe that what the way we think things should be, and we feel free to vent on social media or express ourselves in any number of ways, and we all know, you know, throughout history that the church has at various times felt itself required, bidden by God, to disobey the government. And so there's some, you know, there's some real questions to wrestle through there, notwithstanding the even bigger question about the problem of evil. If God really is sovereign, why is there so much crap, right? Why do bad things happen? Why do real bad things happen? Natural disasters, war crimes, inhumanity of humans one to another. So this doctrine of the sovereignty of God introduces questions that we need to wrestle with, but Paul gives it to us here as a deep comfort that we can trust God with what's going on in our government. And he's writing to ancient Roman people in Rome, and if you know anything about ancient Roman civilization and what some of the emperors did, then you have some idea of how hard this would have been. Like, how can Paul really say this, that these people are here because God has appointed them? That they are not just appointed by God, three times, ministers, servants of God, three times. Because he knows that people are going to say, "What, Paul, Nero, have you met him? This man is not a servant of God." But Paul is reminding us that the prophets told us that Cyrus, who was a world conqueror of his day and would just destroy whole civilizations and glory about it, boast about it, brag about it, that Cyrus was the anointed one in that day. He was a Christ. He was a Messiah, which is, both those words mean anointed one. Scripture tells us that God appointed Cyrus for this role, this task of world domination during that time. So again, things to wrestle with, folks. But Paul tells us there's a comfort here because it frees us up from feeling like that it's up to us, that we need to make things change or make things different. If I believed that the well-being of Medicine Hat or Canada was on my shoulders, I would be a wreck for sure. I'd probably just numb myself in some way or another, but I mean, that's not a healthy way to imagine trying to carry that kind of weight. But I don't. I believe God's in control, even when I don't see that, or even when it doesn't look like the way I would want things to work out. So a deep, settled confidence in God's power and authority, a settled and deep confidence in this truth, that God is in control, allows us to be good citizens. And that's, in fact, what God asks us to do. Be a good citizen. If your government is thriving, then the church and the people of God have the potential to also thrive. And if you've ever been in a part of the world in which there is unrest and no real clear government, you know, like either civil war or other sorts of stuff, you could just realize how hard it would be to do much of anything except for just survive. So, anyway, that's the first piece. The second piece is, though love is self-evident, I think, not quite as maybe controversial as saying, you know, thanks God for the government and thanks for these elected officials, they're your servant, and I need to do what I can to support them, encourage them, give honor where honor is due. you know, gladly pay my taxes as part of my service to you, because I'm encouraging and supporting your servants, Justin Trudeau, Danielle Smith, you know, whoever it is. Love seems maybe more obvious to us, but I think the same thing is true, that we only can love if we have a deep and settled confidence in God. Because love costs us. It's hard to love. I mean, I think it's hard to love. Perhaps you don't. Perhaps it's easy for you to love the other. I'm not talking about being in love or loving your children even, although that can sometimes be demanding as well. I'm talking about loving the other. And you may recall that, because Paul is quoting Jesus, you may recall that Jesus said, you want to know what sums up all the law and the prophets? Love God, love your neighbor. And somebody said, yeah, Jesus, I have an easy way out of that one. Who's my neighbor? Jesus says, telling the story of the Good Samaritan, that the neighbor is the person you meet who is in need. That's who you love. You love the person that you meet that's in your life that has a need. And that's costly. And unless I'm confident in God, so let's say I have $10, and I meet you, and you need $10. And I say to myself, well, I also need $10. Why should I give $10 to them if I need the $10? Who's going to look after me? And I keep the $10 in my pocket against that potential need, because I don't trust God. I mean, that's one way to look at it. There's other, it's a complicated issue. I'm not trying to be oversimplistic here, although I am being very oversimplistic. But we will not truly love, okay, first of all, we need to be loved by God. That's the key ingredient. But unless we can trust God and rest in that, either that God is able or that he's willing, and most of us probably theoretically at least say, yeah, God's able to do all sorts of things, but I doubt that he will do that for me or look after me in that way. And that's where the rub is, and that's where we fail then to love, because we don't have the resources out of which to love. So I see Paul, again, Paul always tells us this is what's true, that's why we live this way. And what he's done today is he said, this is what's true, God's completely in control. And he ends the passage by pointing us to that end of time in which the veil will be rolled back, and we'll see that God has always been in control, and he will establish then in time and space that fullness, that completeness of his control. We live by faith, we live by hope, Paul has reminded us several times. But it's that confidence in what God is doing, has said will happen, that gives us the freedom to love, to submit to authority, etc. These are both quite radical principles, like I said, even though they are also quite conservative as far as reinforcing the status quo. They get radical when we tie them into both Ezekiel and this passage in Matthew chapter 18. You may be familiar with this. It's a pretty famous passage, in part famous because certain churches, well, all churches used to enact it. Basically, it'd be like if I knew that you were in sin, even our prayer book, the BCP, if I knew that you were in sin, I would turn you away from the altar. I'd say, no, not today. You've got stuff you need to clear up. I should have had that conversation with you beforehand. I probably would have, but and that's provided right in the rubrics in the BCP. That's not something that most Anglican churches, I think, would do today or for the last several decades. And many other churches have walked away from that kind of church discipline, but that's what, this is the go-to passage, right? If you know someone sinned, you go to them. If they don't listen, you bring a couple witnesses. If they don't listen to that small group, you bring it to the council of the church and you publish it. You basically say, so-and-so is now no longer part of our fellowship. You treat them like an unsaved person. So you don't, you know, you don't have the fellowship with them that you would with your other brothers and sisters. Like I said to the children, these are important things, like God says to Ezekiel. You need to warn people. I love this way that passage ends. God says, what, you think I want the wicked to die in their sin? I have no pleasure in that. Rather, that they would repent and turn and live. And then he says, turn back, turn back. Why would you choose to die, O Israel? Why would you choose to die? If you don't hear the love and compassion that's motivating that statement, I think it's very obvious. God is speaking out of love when he warns us. He's speaking out of love. The road is closed. You missed that sign. You're headed towards a disaster. You need to stop. And that's what this passage in the gospel is all about. But it has to be motivated by love. It has to be surrounded by love, a genuine love. Only then is it fulfilling the law or the righteous requirement of God. And because it's been done outside of love, at least sometimes, it leaves a bitter taste in most of our mouths, I think. I mean, I really think it's not a happy thought, really, I think. For me, it isn't. Church discipline like that, confronting people, and then just sort of banding together as a group and saying, you're shunned now. But we need to weigh that, and this piece in Ezekiel's been over abused too. Like their blood is on your head if you don't warn them. These are again complicated parts of our history as a church, complicated parts of our journey as God's people. But when we hear and remember that these were designed to be evidences of God's love and an enactment of God's love on the part of his people, then I think we're in a safer place to ask, what does that mean for me today? How, God, do you have a call on my life today about this? Can I act in love? If so, am I willing to act in love? But without the love, then it's not a righteous thing. It's not the law. It's not the fulfillment of God's purpose and intent, a fulfillment of the law. Because Paul says, love fulfills the whole law. Whatever command there is, it can be summed up in this. Love your neighbor as yourself. So, we're in this place, I think, where we're invited to reflect on what we do. Like I said last week, what does it look like to take up my cross and follow? Well, it looks like this: to love each other, to prefer and honor, to die to my own needs and be awake and alive to others. So today too, we're being asked not just what should we do, but in what spirit, what attitude, how do I live? Is an important question. But an even more important question is, what is my motivation in that? And we're reminded that this is about love. And we're strengthened and encouraged in that, because love is, to choose to love is to choose to be vulnerable and to choose to be weak. And there's all lots of good things about love too, don't get me wrong. But when you choose to love, you open yourself up to hurt, disappointment. You deplete resources that you could conserve and use for your own desires or wants. And the only way to do that genuinely, non-pathologically, is to be robustly planted in the love of God and in a confidence in his goodness and in his power, his authority. This, I think, as it did in the ancient world, has the potential, Well, it doesn't have the potential. This is a revolutionary force, a subversive activity, an incredible power that we bring to the world as God's children. Love is very radical. And increasingly in our world, in our culture today, I think it's the only response that we can give. Everything else, if you say something, it gets polarized and polemical and becomes a political nightmare. I mean, just, you know, go on social media. You know what I'm talking about, I think. You can't say anything today, but you can love. You can love. And this is love. Not that we love God, but that He first loved us. And in the power and strength and the reality of that, we go forth as His children, modeling His love to the world and becoming the very hands and feet of Christ in our world. And because I'm excited about this stuff, you know, Paul talks about putting on the armor, and he invokes this image several times. And that's kind of, I think we need to get excited about this. It's a revolutionary and subversive activity. And I want you to think a bit today and this week about being a subversive force in our culture in the name of love and in the power and the authority of love. Amen.